Thanks for tuning in to the Medivac podcast, powered by the Robert Irvine Foundation, whose mission is to support and strengthen the physical and mental well-being of our nation's heroes and their families. I'm one of your hosts, David Reed.
And I'm your other host, Christian Myers. Thank you very much for joining us today on the Medivac podcast. If you're new here, and you might be, there's a price for the show. You have to share it with a friend or family member if you get something out of today's episode. Our guest today is Nick O'Kelly. Nick is a former Army personnel. He spent about 13 years in the Army. He was a Green Beret that transitioned into being an H-60 pilot. So he flew Blackhawks for the last part of his career with the 160th, which is a prestigious Army flight unit. Welcome, Nick. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for coming in today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. It's a pleasure.
Yeah.
Super exciting. Well, we'll dive right into the story and ask you, what inspired you to join the military?
I have a very unique story with that. Probably, actually, maybe not too unique, but I was in college after high school. I did all the normal things, went to college like I should have, didn't really have a desired outcome by going to college. So I partied too much and drank my way out of college after about a year and a half.
Yeah.
My dad told me I'm not paying for this anymore.
It's a very common thing that we see across military members.
I believe it.
Just college is not always the best choice for some individuals.
Exactly. It was the right idea in concept, but not the right idea in how I executed.
Yeah.
Wrong time, maybe.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
But so I was in ROTC when I was in college, so that exposed me to the military. So when I left school, I came to the realization that I had to do something with my life. And so I first went to the Marine recruiter, and because Marines sounded cool, right?
Yeah, you know, of course.
They're way cooler than every other branch before you're in the military. So I do that, go to them, and then they tell me, you're not guaranteed a job. You know, you can come in the Marines, but you might be a cook or you're subject to whatever the Marines
does. Terrible. You unless you're infantry, right? Then they'll be like, oh, exactly. Yeah, come on in. Yeah,
exactly. We need more of you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So walked down to the Army recruiter and they showed me this cool Special Forces recruiting video after they tried to pitch me on some other stuff. But luckily I had good ASVAB scores, so I could have done anything. And I watched that video and I was like, that's the coolest thing I've ever seen in my life. Let's do it. And the recruiter was like, you sure? Like nobody makes it that I've put through this.
This is hard.
Yeah, this is hard. And I'm like, all right, let's do it. Mm-hmm. So that's nice. That's really my entry to the military story. So I entered with an 18 X-ray contract. And then, my story starts from there. Went to Benning, did the whole infantry basic, and then went up to the Q course at Bragg.
Nice. And how did that training go through for you? Any recycles, injuries?
No. So I was...
Damn.
Yeah. So I was... Nice. I was fortunate to not get injured at all. Yeah. And I had a pretty solid running background, which goes so... As you guys know, goes so far in the military.
Yeah.
So I was running I don't want to brag, but 11-minute 2 miles when I came in the Army. So I was just flying, you know, and... That honestly translates to rucking and everything else that you do in the military. So, or in the SF.
And land navigation just crushes a lot of people as well.
It does. And I think, I don't know, but I think my ROTC time actually helped a lot with that.
Oh, I'm sure it did.
I had that foundation already, whereas the other guys were just coming in straight raw and had no exposure to it.
Makes sense.
So at least I had the basic map reading skills and had done it before.
So that goes through, you get... Go through training without a hitch. And what's next?
Yeah, so graduated 2012 from the Q course as an 18 Charlie, which is the demo engineer.
Okay.
And spoke Korean, kind of, if you can call it speaking Korean. It was enough to pass the test.
Yeah.
So that put me out in first group, so that's Asia. And I went out to Okinawa, which is 1st Battalion.
Okay.
So I spent 3 years on an ODA out there. And got to travel all of Asia, really. It was a really awesome experience. Got to see different cultures. And it's cool seeing how third world countries and their cultures, live, you know, compared to how we do over here.
I mean, it's a bit of a, was it your first time out of the country, or?
Other than like Canada and Mexico, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So you're but getting, those were like vacations, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And those are very Americanized. Exactly. They're vacation areas. So.
Exactly.
Yeah. It gives you some exposure to the world.
Yep.
Seeing that cultural difference and bringing that knowledge back to the United States is very, very different as well. I mean, and we could have a whole podcast on that as well as just like the sense of entitlement that we have here. And it's not even, sometimes it's not even forced. It's just the way of life here where you have access to everything and you don't have that in a lot of places. Yeah. So is, what are like some of the biggest things? I'm curious on like what you learned culturally, which kind of translated and helped you kind of navigate through that when you got back home.
And that probably is, you already talked about it. Like the biggest thing is just contentment, you know, like they could just have a soccer ball and that's it to their name and they have fun with it, you know?
Like, yeah.
I mean, I'm sure they're not always rainbows and butterflies, but from our perspective, like they're content with that and they're happy with that.
Yeah.
We're here, you know, we're always
here. Can't even go out in the rain without, you know, being complaining or our shoes getting dirty. Like,
nope, exactly.
And you know, they're playing soccer in this muddy field with no shoes and, you know, taggered clothes. It's very eye opening.
Yeah. Makes you appreciative.
One of the best things you could do is travel for experience.
I agree.
And to understand that. And I think that's a really huge part of what the audience needs to hear too, is like, get out, go travel and see the world before you make an opinion. Right.
And you learn like gratitude, right? Like, you travel and you're just like, man, we have it made. Mm-hmm. And we don't always think that, right? Like, it's not like every day I wake up and I'm like, oh, I got it made because I'm not in a third world country. And but when you're there,
you appreciate it. You see that translated into, you know, those who are very vocal about the politics. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, you go anywhere else in the world, especially third world countries, you're not involved in politics. You're worried about getting through the day.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. What am I going to have to eat? You know, all this stuff.
For sure.
And that is eye-opening. But I didn't mean to detract from the story. That's just an interesting one, just being able to travel very, very young in your career as well.
Yeah, it was really nice. And another thing on that cultural difference is kind of the family construct. Mm. Like, is a little different there, right?
Very tight-knit.
Yeah, very tight-knit. You take care of each other. You know, you take care of your parents, things like that. Yeah. Where, you know, my parents live in Seattle and I live in Charlotte.
Yeah.
The other side of the country.
And people separate. And I think that's, we talk about that too, is like the family connection kind of breaks down a little bit now, especially lately, where you can have a kid live in totally different states. No one's meeting for holidays anymore. And I mean, to be honest, you get other organizations that are influencing the family now here.
Yeah. I think the community aspect is very important. I think that is something that we're missing here. Something that's fallen off, unfortunately. Like the last time I really saw a community aspect in this country was, you know, 9/12, right? 9/12 syndrome, right? Everyone came together after this big tragedy. We haven't had anything like that really that brought us closer together.
Good point.
Yeah.
And the perfect example of that is if somebody knocks on your door, you're like, who is that? Instead of like when we were kids.
Me, I run and hide now. I'm like, is it the cops?
Yeah, right? Just kidding.
It is like when you have someone knock on your door, you open it and you're like, what do you want?
Right.
And, you know, I see this in my neighborhood. Every neighborhood I've been in the last 10 years is, you know, no one's out playing anymore. You don't know your neighbors even.
Yeah. You don't want to.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Because when we were kids, it was like somebody knocked on the door. You're excited.
And true now story. It's
like, who's there?
Why are you knocking on my door? It's 7 p.m.
Yeah. You know? What are you doing here?
Yeah. So it's a totally different dynamic.
But. Yeah. So back to the story here, Okinawa, you get to travel all of Asia, which is incredible, especially earlier in your career. You know, us Army infantrymen, you know, get, especially Rangers, you get two choices, two states, you know, it's Washington or Georgia.
And not even a choice.
Yeah. And you get, two choices, maybe if you're lucky.
Right. But
yeah, so you're traveling around and what does that look like? This is year 2012?
2012 is when I got to Okinawa.
When you get to your unit. And I mean, things are in full bore. Like we just had initiated the second surge of Afghanistan. How was the temperament when you got there?
It was actually a little awkward for me because my company was in Afghanistan when I got to the company. Mm. So a lot of people think of 1-1, which first group, first battalion is not like combat, really more JSIT style. But during that era, you know, every group was recycling in and out. Mm-hmm. So they had literally lost somebody in the company, I think a week after I showed up. So it was very, very, very awkward, you know, being, and there were a group of us, new guys that got there at the same time. So we were all rear D and, yeah, it was just awkward. All the older or senior NCOs were not accepting of us because, mm-hmm. you know, when you go on a deployment, you get tight, right? So we were the new guys.
Yeah.
We were going to get treated like crap anyways, being mm-hmm. the new guys, but this just kind of made it worse. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it was a little awkward. Mm-hmm. It took a long, I'd say probably a good 9 months to actually get over that and start integrating with them. Usually it was like a trip or two, you know, and get comfortable.
You see like a big difference between like pretty much around that time, 2012 to 2015, 16, where you have the senior NCOs who have been on multiple deployments at this time. That was just a hard time for people to enter the military. You're still going, but it's towards the end. Everything's kind of wrapping up a little bit. And you probably got a lot of that.
For sure. Being the guy with no deployment patch, no CIB, you know, walking around with all these.
Very cherry.
And I'm sure that you saw that kind of progress as you were ranking up too. Around 2015, when the new guys came in, same kind of concept, I'm sure.
For sure. And it's even like that today, I would say.
Yeah.
You know, well, especially now.
Now you have even senior NCOs who haven't deployed.
Yeah.
Exactly. Which is very strange.
It's a huge shift.
That's very prominent in the Marine Corps right now. They have their whole upper echelon has no deployments or maybe one deployment at best.
It's pretty surprising.
When you know we enter a new combat realm like we're dipping our toes into right now, makes me curious about what's going to happen with that. You know,
That's totally different landscape.
Yeah, I definitely want to pivot the conversation into that when the time comes, as well as what recruitment looks like now is brutal.
Yeah. In the toilet. I've seen some of those stats. It's pretty scary, honestly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you're talking about initiating a new draft and maybe they're not going to be forward facing, but it'd still be logistics. Yep. And that is, that's
still
wrong,
scary,
right?
Because you still need that. Like it's still important, you know?
Yeah.
Even though we belittle other aspects of the military, wrongly probably, but it's still important, right?
As the pendulum swings, it's more and more extreme, right? And then it does find equilibrium.
Yeah.
And I think now we're starting to see this, we're definitely seeing this in our first responders, is an appreciation for what we so just objected from. Mm-hmm. You know, police, for instance, defund the police. Now it's like, let's fund them up because the crime is out of control.
Yeah. This went the direction we thought it would. Surprise.
I know. Seriously.
Yeah. Okay. So you get to your unit, you have to prove yourself, obviously, like anyone else. And what does that look like for you deployments wise?
Yeah. So I did, I don't remember all the exact numbers, but I did a few JSITs to Philippines, two to the Philippines. I did one to Nepal, which was pretty cool. We got to do Everest Base Camp while we were there, which was amazing.
Very cool.
Yeah. Getting per diem while doing Everest Base Camp was pretty awesome. Yeah. And then I did a combat 6-month deployment to the Philippines. Okay. Classified as a combat deployment, but it was more advising and assisting their special operations guys.
Okay. So you're out there training them and running them through scenarios.
Okay. Helping them with their training pipelines and things like that. And then they were pretty active in combat down in the southern islands of the Philippines. There's some pretty extreme terrorist groups out there.
Yeah.
So
they're still doing activities today, right?
Sure they are. Honestly, I don't know.
It is dangerous.
Sure. Yeah.
It's dangerous in some of those areas.
Yeah.
Can you educate people a little bit on what's, you know, who the terrorist organizations are out there, or like what, or are you still aware?
So I'm sure it's changed a lot.
Yeah.
Because that was in 2013.
Okay. So 10 years.
So today, I don't know if I'd be giving out accurate information, to be honest.
What was the conflict that you were facing at the time?
So it was a group called Abu Sayyaf, which was prominent down there. I know a lot of the backside motivation is the drug running and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very prominent out there.
Exactly. So, but the Filipino special operations guys, they were getting they were getting their ass kicked. Like it was pretty intense.
And they're fighting against guerrilla assets as well.
Who are very well funded.
For sure.
With the drug trade.
And even though the Filipino military is like, the guys have no quit in them. Mm-hmm. Like their core soldiers are amazing. Mm. They don't have the like training that we have, right?
Yeah.
Or the resources that we have. So it's a lot different when somebody's going, literally doing CQB with like an M1, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Like a semi-auto like rifle. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And we got, you know, we got sexy M4s and everything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or scars, whatever.
Yeah.
So it's a totally different dynamic.
Can you talk about a little bit about the brutality and their methods?
So I actually was not exposed to that.
Okay.
So
But you heard some stories. I mean, you were in the unit, right?
Yeah, but I don't have any firsthand like
experience
with that, to be honest.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was more focused on the operational side or the training side.
Well,
so
to educate everybody, it was brutal. It still is to this day. It's brutal in some areas you don't even want to cross under. It's kind of like old school Colombia.
Yeah.
Okay.
Certain areas you just don't go.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was in Colombia earlier this year and it was plenty fine. Like go downtown Cartagena was fine.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Yeah.
No problems definitely at all. But they said, don't leave Cartagena. I said, okay.
Just going to go on a hike.
Yeah. They said, do not leave downtown. Like, got it.
Like little America right here.
Yeah,
you're
yeah,
not allowed exactly anywhere else.
Yeah, do not leave.
Yeah. Yeah. So Philippines, obviously you had some sort of package there. Your guys were doing their thing. What else turned about on that trip?
So honestly, that was a pretty cush trip. Mm-hmm. Like it wasn't, there was no drama.
I think it's really important to note that like these skirmishes are happening all over the world and we just have this focal point where we think it's the Middle East and that's it.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. And everybody always wonders like, you know, why are there people deploying and why are people still going on deployments? And it's because of that. There's always something, you know.
There's that misconception that, well, we're not at war anymore. It's like, well, we're at war everywhere.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It just don't know about it. And they're usually proxy wars as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And if we're not at war, we're helping our allies
with
training or something like that, or logistics, you know,
mm-hmm. Especially with Green Berets, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's core competency, right?
Yeah, like it's your entire
force
purpose.
Multiplier. Yeah,
exactly.
Yep.
Yeah. Which, you know, knowing that too, I always love to ask this to our Green Berets as well, is how is the comfortability level, the differences in culture and training these guys to trust them alongside you? That's got to be a point of contention across the board.
Yeah. So I would say that depends on who you're working with. Because
mm-hmm.
from my experience in the Philippines, those guys, we first group basically stood up some of their special operations regiments. So we're really tight with them.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're like our little brothers in a way, mm-hmm. you know? So the relationship was great. The trust was great. There was no like hesitation, to be honest,
mm-hmm.
with those guys. I'm sure other places it's a lot different, but absolutely. In my experience, we didn't have any trust issues or
that's good.
Yeah. Anything like that.
Well, Afghanistan, Iraq. I mean, there was always the
constability
of green
different
blue,
story right? Yep, because money drives everything there. You know, there's not much patriotism mm-hmm. where there is in the, like, I keep using the Philippines because that's my experience, but they're very patriotic. Like they're all about their country, where in the Middle East, as you guys know, it's more driven by money and other motivations, you know,
mm-hmm. money, religious affiliations,
or fear of, you know, your family.
Yeah. Retaliation.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Things like that. Mm. So
that makes sense.
So go ahead, Christian,
please after you. so you wrap up your time in the Philippines and that's your last, operation with,
that was my last
being in group.
Yes. Other than a trip to Australia for training and stuff like that. But, so my son was born in March 2014.
Mm-hmm.
So I literally left for the Philippines like a month after he was born.
Okay.
And it was kind of a transition point for me of like, I'm gone so much with this job that I need to be a parent to at some point, you know? So I started looking, And I actually didn't mention this, but I was looking into flight school before I even joined the Army. So mm-hmm. I was looking at the high school to flight school program.
Yeah.
But it was taking so long to go through that process that I just needed to get in.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So that was in the back of my head. So then I, during that Philippine deployment is when I worked on my flight packet and dropped it.
Okay.
Yeah, I just wanted something. In my mind, being a pilot was a little more stable.
Sure.
And then also looking at like the pay scale of, you know, a warrant officer compared to an enlisted guy, I was like, okay, like I'll be doing a little better by my family by doing this. So,
mm-hmm.
so yeah, that was my big motivation to do that.
Okay. So you drop your flight packet and your goal, what was your goal to fly H-60s, Blackhawks?
It actually was.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is most people in flight school don't say that.
Yeah.
Don't say Blackhawks
or Apaches, number one. Right?
Yeah. yeah. Or Chinooks, but yeah. like. Yeah, I just love the Blackhawk. It's such a sexy beast. Like,
yeah.
mm-hmm. it's got the best of everything, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was. I did want to fly Blackhawks.
Okay.
So I went to Fort Rucker in May of 2015, and then I ended up being the number one dude in my flight school somehow. So I was a distinguished honor grad.
Nice. It's so funny that you struggled through college. And it wasn't struggling through college, right? It was just the extracurricular activities that got you, right?
100%.
Because you got a great ASVAB score, head of your flight class. It's just all about direction and who needs to guide you. And you don't have that, really.
I was a 4.0 student through high school. Like,
yeah.
I was the guy, well, it was almost not self-directed. It was like my parents made me do it, you mm-hmm. know?
Yeah.
So I had the capability to easily graduate college. I just would party every night, sleep in till noon and be like, well, missed class again.
Yeah.
guess it's so too that, late now.
That, with that structure and that focus, yeah. you were able to flip it
exactly.
and come out top of your flight class,
yeah.
which also gives you a choice. And did you have a choice between an Apache and a 60?
I did. So,
man.
Yeah, no, I didn't want to fly Apaches, man. Have you met Apache pilots? I'm just
kidding. Who hasn't?
Yeah, yeah, they'll
let you know right away.
You know, I fly Apaches, I'm just right? kidding.
Yeah, Apaches and CrossFit.
Yeah, yeah exactly. Yep. Yeah. That's right.
A vegan Apache pilot.
That's oh, right.
Boy, that's triple trouble. Yeah, so you choose the 60.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that's got to be an amazing experience getting behind that.
It's so much fun. Mm. Yeah. The first time you fly it, I mean, you don't know what you're doing, right?
Yeah.
So I was the first flight school class in the Army that flew Lakotas.
Mm-hmm.
Or the second one, sorry. I was the second class.
Okay.
So I didn't do the 67, which was like the old school, no hydraulics, everything's super hard. The Lakota was like hydraulics and had some autopilot systems and things like that. So. Mm-hmm. Of course, all the old school guys are like, you're getting out easy, you know,
yeah.
you're well, not which, a real pilot.
Which less hard I have a problem with that.
I do too.
I have a problem with
it's
that.
It's ridiculous.
And like Christian and I talk about this all the time with this new technology that comes available and everybody's like, oh, well, that's cheating. And it's not cheating. It's making the fundamentals a little easier for you so that you could focus on bigger picture things,
yeah.
right? If we, in RASP, we see this as well. We put these guys through a schoolhouse now where they have a month-long program to learn what it means to be a Ranger. They come in way better educated, and yet the old guys are still like, well, you never went to RIP. You know, you went to RAFs back when it was hard.
Yeah, right.
It's the same thing with the calculator in mathematics, you know?
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Well, we're going to these advanced airframes, like we're going to a Blackhawk or an Apache or Chinook that has all these
If you're without
systems.
Hydraulics,
right.
yeah. so, when are you ever in that situation?
Yeah,
you know?
So why are we training on this archaic helicopter?
Yes.
Like, I mean, I get the like basic flight controls,
mm-hmm.
but you learn that in any helicopter.
Yeah.
Like you learn how to hover regardless, you know?
And that's train how you fight.
So, exactly.
Train how you fight.
Exactly what it is. Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So I agree, though. It's funny.
Yeah.
I don't get it.
It's so that you could make room for bigger improvements.
Exactly.
And bigger strides. So you're behind this thing. And talk about your first solo flight. How was that?
So actually, they don't do solo flights anymore.
You got your co. Yeah. You're behind the first stick, right? How's that feel?
Yeah, so it was scary, to be honest.
Mm. Yeah.
Because you go from this, I don't remember how the weight of the Lakota, but it was probably half the size, if that, of a Blackhawk.
Yeah.
And it's just intimidating. Like,
yeah.
you're in there, the cockpit's totally different. You're not used to anything. You don't know where where any of the buttons are other than just, you know, from your classes.
Yeah.
You get the basic classes, so you have an idea, but it's not real until you actually go in.
This is a great example, too, of the future of training. Now we're seeing these simulation cockpits that you could go in, learn, get hundreds of hours before you even get, you know, behind that rotor.
For sure. But I will say the simulators don't, like, some of them, they're good. But they're not even close to the same.
Yeah. The seat of the pants thing, right?
Yeah, for sure. Like picking up that Blackhawk for the first time.
Talk about in 10 years, though. Let's talk about in 10 years, 15, 20 years. Now we have VR, you know, and, and all this technology that's coming out that is going to make it easier.
You
could fly a F-35 without getting behind it and know the fundamentals first.
Yeah. It's pretty crazy. Yeah. Especially with everything's going digital, even in the cockpit, you know? Even some of the new like dust landing systems, you know, you're flying instruments, which means you're flying off the screen from 50 feet down. You're not even looking outside anymore.
Yeah.
You know, so a lot of those things you can do in the simulator because of that.
Mm. Yeah.
Because it's the same screen that you're looking at. The controls might be a little different and you won't feel it as much, but conceptually it's a good way to train for sure.
Fun. Yeah. That's gotta be fun.
It is.
So you do a deployment with 1/60th. So you get picked up. So after flight school, did you get to pick your unit? What was the deal with that?
So you get I think it's a top either 3 or 5 choices, whatever. It's like a OML basically. Mm-hmm. And Savannah was definitely one of my top choices, mostly because all the other choices weren't as appealing, you know, as far as location. And then I also knew 3rd Cap was deploying right away. And when you're in flight school, you know, like all you little students are so excited to get out in the real world, right? Absolutely. So deployment is like, yay, I get to do something real, you know?
Spend all this time training.
Exactly. So I was really excited for that. And then you also, the career progression's a lot faster if you deploy quickly because you get so many hours on a deployment.
Yeah.
So I think I got like 500 combat hours in 9 months or something like that. Over 500.
Wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it was a lot. It was like 7-8 hours a day almost.
Yeah.
Almost consistently, other than like rest days. But
and what was your average duty when you're downrange?
So that was the frustrating thing about the regular Army is it was a lot of just moving ass and trash. Just airfield to airfield, picking up a part, you know, just doing ring routes. So that was kind of one of my epitomes of like, okay, this is not what I wanted to do as a pilot, you know? I could have gone and flown airplanes if I wanted to land at airfields.
Yeah.
So that was my...
Especially with your experience being a Green Beret.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And honestly, like in the regular Army as a warrant officer, as a new warrant officer, you get treated pretty shitty. Like
it's even like, with that long tab?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
I know. It was shocking.
Which is how many pilots had the long tab?
Not many.
Yeah. Not many.
Even in the 160th,
I'd be like,
many. I know, man. Like
right here.
Unfortunately. Yeah.
You can't haze the hazer, man.
Yeah. And it wasn't even hazing. I think it's just the nature of the regular Army, you know?
That's another thing too, is that chip on your shoulder.
Yeah.
Where does that stem from?
I don't know.
You know?
And everything's so reactive, you know? Like there's no forward looking on anything. It's just, oh my gosh, this happened. We got to do this now. And it's like, okay.
Yeah.
Then let's do it. You don't have to freak out about it. Like
now it's an emergency.
Right. Yeah. And it was just constantly things like that. Mm. And then you're called a WOJ as a warrant officer junior grade. So it's a derogatory term. So you're the WOJ when you get there, which basically means you're a private. Mm-hmm. Like I'm serious because the maintainers, as you know, in a helicopter unit, maintainers are so busy. They don't have time to do the like BS details that nobody wants to do. Mm-hmm. So that falls on the WOJs. So the WOJs are doing all the,
So
you go from being an E6 Green Beret, you know, having fun, you know, shooting guns, blowing stuff up to being this WOJ. You know what I mean?
Back to the bottom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Back to 6 a.m. PT and just
and there was sucking. Was there any respect towards what your prior service was? Or was it just like...
A little bit, but it's almost like people didn't know what it was,
you
know, which is weird.
Yeah.
I know. It's bizarre.
It says, but like, you, like, you'd cool, be like, cool. You used to be my taxi service, bro. Shut up.
Seriously. Yeah, I know. The Uber of the sky.
Yeah. Sky Ubers. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was a weird dynamic shift.
Yeah.
So you realize that conventional army is not where you want to be.
Yeah.
Spend a 9-month deployment overseas with them.
Yep. But
you got good experience. That 500 hours, like that
saved me, honestly.
That's a lot.
Because we'll get into it later. We're gonna have to backtrack to talk about like the kind of mental health side of all this.
Yeah.
But it got me to the point where I was like, it was like a do or die, like get into the 160th or get out of the army.
Yeah.
Like that's how fed up I was.
Yeah.
Just the micromanagement and, like I said, the reactiveness of everything. Mm-hmm. It was just so frustrating, especially when you have a better answer, but nobody cares, you know? Mm-hmm. It's just, there's nothing you can do.
It's the way we're doing it.
Yeah.
It's the way we've always done
it. So tail end of that deployment, I dropped my 160th packet because I got 500 hours and you have to be a PC, pilot in command as well. So I made pilot in command in Afghanistan. Got back, I had like a month off and then I went to assess, which was perfect because I was in 9-month deployment shape, you know?
Yeah.
Flying so I was like, day. Yeah, let's go, man. Like, this is the best shape I've been in years. So, I went to assess, did their week long assessment, and got picked up. I was like the poster child candidate, that, you know, like former Green Beret. Still young, still like moldable, you know what I mean? Motivated, all that good stuff. So.
So you got picked up into 160th. Can you tell the audience what's 160th is so prestigious for?
Yeah. So 160th is the Special Operations Aviation Regiment. Mm-hmm. So basically any like major operation, not any, but most major operations that you've heard of, 160th was probably a part of it. So Black Hawk Down's where everybody's going to recognize the 160th.
Yeah. From.
So that was their, obviously one of their biggest, like most famous missions.
Yeah.
Gothic Serpent.
Yep. Yeah. Exactly. But yeah, it stemmed out of the 101st. So it started at Fort Campbell and then they just started experimenting and basically saying like, hey, we need a special operations aviation regiment or aviation asset.
Mm-hmm.
And they just started a program out of the 101st and then it be
slowly. And you get a newer, merged. Slicker 60.
Yeah.
That you got
we
behind.
Get the Ferrari of the 60s.
Ooh. Yeah.
Brand new off the line, I'm sure.
Yeah. Sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes.
Yeah. So what are the salient differences between conventional Army asset and the SOAR asset? So you guys have obviously much higher qualifications. What are some of those things include?
As far as the helicopter is concerned, well, or as far as the training?
Yeah, whether it's helicopter technology or the training, stuff that you can, you know, obviously discuss.
Yes. Biggest differences, yeah.
Yeah, so the helicopter inside, outside, it looks similar, other than the, like, probe for HAR.
All black.
Helicopter air-to-air refuel. Yeah, it's all black.
Yeah.
So it looks sexy in that regard.
Yeah.
Real mean.
Yeah, you look at it.
You can see the biggest difference is between the Chinooks, like, right, conventional.
Oh, yeah.
And
the no conventional difference. Ones look like an ugly bus in the sky.
It's an ugly green
160th
bus.
160th ones, you're like, all right, that looks scary.
Yeah, it's got a huge, yeah.
The green looks cool when it's off the line, but once it's used,
it
hits the sun in any capacity.
That's right. For sure. So it's a lot heavier. Hmm. So the regular Black Hawk sits at, I think, 15,000 pounds.
Do you, 16825 is the typical.
That's right.
Like
that's like what all the limitations are based off of. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we would take off regularly over 20,000 pounds.
Yeah.
Like around 21, 22. So
significant.
So that's the biggest difference. I mean, we have different engines and everything.
Sure.
Different. Yeah. So mechanically, it's a big difference.
It's funny Sikorsky, who makes the helicopter, was like, 16825 is about the max that you should ever put on this helicopter, and at 10,000 hours, you should get rid of them entirely. And the Air Force and the Army were like, no, your engineers are wrong. Yeah. Yes. We'll fly these for 40 years at 22,000 pounds.
That's right. Screw your limits. Yeah.
But that's
why
they
hold my beer.
They're broken after every run.
Right.
You know, just
I know.
Like,
I know.
It never makes you feel uncomfortable about getting in a helicopter. You're like, well, these are supposed to be thrown away 30 years ago.
Nah, exactly. It just reinforces the idea of how safe they are.
Yeah. That's right. That's right.
It's true. Yeah. I mean, they do work. They're not falling out of the sky very often. So
yeah,
that's why you never shut down though on a
never,
you know, flight. You don't want something to break and have to have to be stuck there. So you just keep it running. But yeah. So, but then mission wise is the big difference with the 160th. Like,
and that's where you got your fix.
Yeah, that's where I got it in.
Instead of doing ring runs, you were now dropping off, picking up,
going to the X. Nice. Yeah, doing the real thing I wanted to do.
I mean, from a pilot's perspective, let's talk about that. Let's talk about landing on the X. What that's like. What's dropping those guys off right in the heat of it.
Yeah, so it's intense. It's a huge adrenaline rush for about a minute. 30 seconds to a minute.
But I mean, you're hearing 10 minute calls in the back.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. The radios are nuts.
That has got to be exhilarating as well. Where you're just like, you know, 2 minutes.
Oh yeah. Especially your first one, man.
Yeah.
And with goggles going, you're just like, you see the stack overhead. You're just like, this is it. Like, this is what
deal.
I signed up to do.
Yeah. So. I always talk about that too. My first experience with that was on a 60, you know, as a passenger. And you know, you're like 10 mics out, blah blah blah. You're all pumped up and ready, and then you land and you get out, and nothing happened. And I was like, damn it, I'm ready to kill.
I know, man. You get so pumped. It's funny.
Yeah, so you have multiple nights like that, more often than not.
For sure.
It's not like the movies where you land and there's gunfire and tracers whizzing past your head. You land and the helicopter takes off and it's quiet again.
Like, right.
Oh, damn it.
Most of the time, you don't even realize people are shooting at you. You're just like,
whoosh. Because it's so loud.
Yeah.
You have no idea.
Yeah.
Unless you see like the tracers or the you know, muzzle flash.
The zip by your head. You're like, what was that?
Yeah, for sure.
Dragonfly. Dragonflies out here.
Dude, I'll tell you one of the funniest things though, as a pilot, like, is dropping off these, you know, elite dudes into like a HLZ and then seeing the like how they get out of the helicopter, and you just see dudes like tripping.
Eat
and
shit. Yeah.
That, in the movies, it's so sexy.
Yeah. That's the worst part, especially exfil out.
Yeah.
You're a hot mess. You got all this gear on. You're trying to rig whatever you have. And we'd have our goggles that were like Velcroed up and you try to strap them down. But most of the time, you're trying to get out of there like a bat out of hell.
Exactly.
So you just get brown out to the face. And it is the worst. Experience ever. Like, you're, and like, I would find myself in the beginning just like running. Like, I didn't know where I was going. I'd be like, the helicopter's that way.
Oh my gosh, it's funny, man.
But it is. It is not graceful at all.
Yeah, no, not at all.
Graceful at all.
It was great going back and like watching the videos.
Dude, the most professional dudes
exactly.
in like, the world.
Literally, yeah. Or as you like worship, you know?
We don't tell people that. Shh.
I know, my bad.
We're graceful.
They're great
it's
after
like
that.
Call of Duty, you just load on the X.
Yeah. Which Call of Duty is impossible, by the way. I'm terrible at it.
Oh,
that's a tangent, but
that is.
But yeah.
Yeah. So that adrenaline spike has got to be huge. And you're all of a sudden doing what you wanted to do in the beginning, which has got to be great.
Which is really cool, especially seeing just like the visual of that, you know, of seeing like, I think I was Chuck 4 on that deployment and just seeing 3 helicopters like perfectly aligned, you know, and all the planning that goes into it. Mm-hmm. Like, as you know, our mission planning is insane. It really is insane. We cover every detail,
minute by
every
minute.
Single detail. Yeah. You know exactly what everything should look like, and it's cool to see it happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
It's really cool to see
it come together.
Yeah, and just be executed.
Any hairy situations that you were in on this one?
No, not really. Other than like a couple landings that were a little. You know, less
shady.
Than ideal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And that's a great point as well, is you don't have just flat little terrain to land.
No.
You have to worry about, I mean, the noise that's pushing through.
Yep. dust.
Yeah. Brownout landings.
Dust
at night.
Is
yeah.
brownout.
Dust is real. Yeah. yeah.
If there's aluminum at all, mm-hmm. like there's all these factors that go into it. And we just think it's getting in your car, turning on the keys and right. just driving to work.
Yeah. Not even close. I wish.
Yeah.
But yeah. it's really cool though. Like it was really gratifying actually going on the deployment and seeing everything come together.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And, like, the organization is amazing, honestly. I'm so grateful for it, but mm-hmm. but yeah.
So you got your time in.
Yep.
And that wrapped up. And what was next for you?
Yeah, so then it was a bunch of training, going through the progression mm-hmm. in the 160th, trying to become a FMQ is what they call it, fully mission qualified. Mm-hmm. So you start out as a BMQ, basic mission qualified. And then your goal is to make FMQ. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of your badge of honor. That's kind of when you like you've made it into the unit, like mm-hmm. long-term, okay. you know?
Yeah.
And it's about 2 years is typically the max time to make FMQ.
Okay.
So I did a bunch of training and planning, plan X's, things like that. And that's honestly, that's really what they're looking for is the planning side of it.
Yeah.
Like how can you brief? How can you deal with
now you're on the leadership side of right. things and
exactly
more administrative in the front
yep.
position.
Exactly. Yeah. Cause once you're an FMQ, then it's your cockpit.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
you're in charge of the cockpit. So sure. you're making all the decisions.
And that was the end of your deployments is going through this training.
So this was the next after, this is basically the first 2 years you get to the unit. Mm-hmm. So I had about a 9 month span after the deployment that I was still going through that. And I actually had my FMQ ride scheduled for April of the next year. This was in 2020, mm-hmm. 2021. It would have been April 2021. Mm-hmm. However, I needed knee surgery in January that year. Mm-hmm. So I opted to do that, which was frustrating because I had to postpone my timeline. Mm-hmm. But yeah, ironically, that ended up being like the last time I flew.
Wow.
Once I got that knee surgery, because everything kind of came to light after that or down, spiraled, I guess.
So I think that really wraps into the mental health struggles that you had throughout your career.
Yeah.
And kind of that pivotal moment where you had to decide whether to stay in or get out.
Yeah.
So how did that look and where did that stem from?
So it stemmed from, I distinctly remember, it was like Halloween timeframe. After my daughter was born and I was in flight school. So this was 2016. Mm-hmm. And there was no ramping up to it or no warning signs. It was literally a punch in the face, like depression mm-hmm. and suicidal thoughts, like mm-hmm. out of nowhere. It
really?
Was so weird.
Interesting.
Yeah, literally out of nowhere. I had no explanation for it. You know, there was no compounding things, at least that I was aware of, that led to it. Mm-hmm. Looking back now, it's a little easier to like
identify
all those mm-hmm. things. You know, my daughter was born. I didn't take paternity leave. I kept going through flight school.
Also mortality is realized when you had a young one born, I'm
true.
Sure.
Yep.
So now it's a separation between your military career and your family life, which is being torn in two different directions.
Yes.
Is never a good thing.
100%.
Yeah.
And then the aspect of like leaving group and becoming this new private again mm-hmm. in flight school and having to deal with these cadre who were, you know, probably not the best soldiers or individuals. Mm-hmm. That's why they were doing that job.
Let me ask honest. You this real quick yeah. is the difference between conventional aviation and 160th aviation. Did you see a difference in that professionalism across the board?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Night and day. Like,
yeah.
I would strive to say that the 160th might be the most professional organization in the Army. I don't know, and maybe not, but it's up there.
Well, your experience with them.
Because
yeah.
the maturity factor. Like, so most guys in that mm-hmm. unit, at least the pilot, from the pilot standpoint, have at least 8 years in the military already. Mm-hmm. You know, they've done their regular time in the Army, and most of them were enlisted before. So it's a lot more mature. Mm-hmm. Audience, which goes a long way.
It just goes to show you when we see these special operations units, premier prestigious organizations, you get a certain level of professionalism and it showcases the fact that you don't need to haze. You don't need to beat people up and treat them like crap. Yeah. You could operate in a professional sense while still educating these guys into doing the missions they were trained to do. Yeah. And it's a lot less of a hostile work environment.
Mm-hmm. Which is what the Air Force does, right? Like, I don't know about your experience, but like, that's what they're striving to do. They're striving to make it a more professional organization, and it seems to be that way.
Yeah, the mm-hmm. Air Force is much more like a business,
right?
That has guns instead right. of, you know, instead of the contrary. Like, conventional Army tactics do not work on Air Force personnel. You can't threaten somebody. You threaten to haze somebody, like, you're going to get in trouble right after that. Yeah. It just doesn't work. But at the same time, like, it's the big boy program. Right. And I think that's the same thing with aviation or special operations. Is you don't have to be here. If you don't want to be here, there's the door.
Yep.
You know, these are the standards. You can meet them or exceed them. And if you fall short, then like, get out.
Yeah. And how does that affect like morale? I'm just curious.
I think it's a net positive.
I believe,
you know, it, yeah. I never spent time in the conventional Army, so I was never really exposed to that other than from the outside. But from an internal standpoint, it's really easy to correct people individually. Like, I can have, you know, somebody who's even lower ranked than me pull me aside and be like, hey, dude, maybe we should try it this way. Yeah. And it's accepted. I know in the conventional Army, like, E4 pulls E6 aside. Like,
nope.
Yeah, no way. No way.
Not going to happen.
Start pounding pavement.
Yeah, and I think that there's a big differentiating factor as well, is when you're a line unit or mm-hmm. when you're in infantry position, anything like that where you're forward facing, that has to be reinforced, right? Yeah. There is no time for questions, yeah. especially from those that are lower enlisted from you. Right. You have to rely on the experience of your team and that education that they've been provided for through numerous amounts of training and deployments. I was a young enlisted when I took over a sergeant position. I was 20 years old.
Yeah.
And I'd have, you know, the late bloomers that would come in at 30 years old, and they do not like to be told what to do.
Yeah.
But you have that exact philosophy of, if you don't like it, sua sponte.
Yeah.
You're
yeah.
out the door.
Yeah.
You're
yeah.
done.
Goodbye.
And so you need some structure like that in the right setting.
Right.
But it also is emphasized and it's multiplied mm-hmm. in the conventional Army, where that's just the standard. This is how I was taught, and this is how it's going to be.
Yeah, and I would say the fact that in special operations you can kick somebody out, mm-hmm. and it is like an all volunteer force yeah. for yep. the most part, makes a huge difference, right?
It
like,
makes all the difference in the
world.
In
the regular Army or conventional military, they have to cater to the lowest
yep.
on the totem pole. You know, yep. so like mm-hmm. if Joe Schmo's notorious for, you know, smoking weed in his room, they have to put something in place so that nobody does it.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly.
So that's kind of where it snowballs from.
Yeah. True story.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
yeah. But to put it in perspective, I only ever stood somebody at Parade West one time.
Nice.
It was because he pulled a gun out, like jokingly. I was like, hey, bud, we're going to play military for a second. Only ever one time.
He's like, what's Parade Rest? We don't do that in there.
And no shit. That was the reaction. Was like, what do you mean? Like, I need you to stand at Parade Rest while I address you right now. He's like, is that a like, can you do that?
That's funny. Like,
that's how the Air Force kind of yeah. works for the most part.
That's awesome. Yeah.
But it works yeah. for the Air Force too.
It does.
And,
it
you
does,
know, yeah. I tell
there's
I
so
tell,
few people. You know,
that's my recommendation at yeah. this at the end of the day when people are like, my son's daughter, whatever, is thinking about joining the military, Air Force, trade yeah. skills.
Yeah. yep. Yep. Air Force. If yeah. my son ever joins, it's like you're going to the Air Force yeah. if you're insisting on joining.
Yeah.
Or maybe the Space Force, who knows?
Yeah.
Unless oh, yeah.
Unless absolutely. Like boats or space.
You got that
yeah.
now.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You like boats or space? Yeah. Computers, Space Force. You like yep. boats? Go to the Navy.
Except,
fine.
You know, I will say is the common misconception across the board about Space Force is you're not going to space on secret aviation missions.
Not yet.
You know, not yet.
Space shuttle door gunner.
You're staring yeah. at a fucking screen in the middle true. Of, you know, Tully Air Force Base, yeah. you know, Greenland.
Middle of nowhere.
That's true.
Population 400, yep. you know. yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so that's an interesting one. So back to the mental health aspect of this, you're really, you get overwhelmed by these emotions that kind of come out of nowhere. Yeah. Mm-hmm. How do you address that? I know it's really hard in aviation specifically to go to your leadership about these problems.
Yeah, so the short answer to that is I didn't. Mm-hmm. I harnessed it all in and tried to like
stuff it down it. With brown.
Yeah, that's what we do, right? That's what we're taught to do.
That's
you know,
the answer.
Yeah, I mean, I always use this analogy of you remember 30th AG first day.
Oh, absolutely.
When you get in the Army, they separate these kids that are suicidal, right? Or having
mental health. There's a lot of them.
Right? And they take their shoelaces.
Yeah.
And that is day one.
Orange vest.
Yeah. That's day one that we see in the Army. Mm-hmm. So that stigma stems from the second we start, not even start basic training. Like, you're in a holdover.
That's a really great point, is you do see mental breakdowns on a daily basis. And it is, I think that that's such a great point, is we see this, we see these actions, this is what it takes. And we always internalize and say, I'm not there.
Right. And how do we respond to that? We're the ones sitting there laughing at them, right? Or being like, you know, losers. Like, that's not going to happen to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then that stigma is born in your head. Like, so then when it happened to me, I'm like, man, I'm not telling anybody about this. I don't want to be that guy, you know.
Yeah.
Make fun of me. I'm going to lose my job.
Right.
And it's not question yourself and everything that you stand for at that point.
Especially because on the outside looking in, like, I had the perfect life, you know, like hot wife, great kids, you know, crushing flight school, all these things, you know, physically fit.
Yeah.
Everything on the outside looked great, but it wasn't, you know, it was broken on the inside, but still I didn't want to expose that. And I didn't want, and all the repercussions of going to behavioral health when you're a pilot, you know, or training to be a pilot.
Yes.
That's a, could be a career ender.
For the most part, yeah.
Right? Like, even just going when you're in flight school, they'll be like, you know, we don't need this guy.
And that apprehension, that apprehension's a hard thing to address in that position, because on one hand, you know you need to take care of yourself. You know you're having, whether they're, you know, depressive thoughts that are leading to suicidal ideation or suicidal thoughts, if you're having that, that's a big problem for you personally, and it's something that needs to be addressed, but you have this major apprehension, like, if I address this, I lose everything else that I've been working for.
Exactly.
And it's such a hard decision for people to make. Like, we know the right answer, right? The right answer is to address it early and to get it figured out. But with the consequences that follow, like, it's such a crapshoot.
It is, because it's so easy to say that now looking back, right? Yeah. Like, yeah, just go get help. Like, what's the big deal?
Yeah.
You know? But when you're in that moment, you're just like, I got to graduate flight school. Like, this is my career, you know? Like, my family's relying on me to support them financially and everything.
Yeah.
And I have aspirations to, you know, be a CW5 in the Army.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to sabotage my career right now, you know, when I still have 10, 15 years left.
Yeah. So you locked that in.
So I did. Yeah.
And for how long?
Too long. Overall, it ended up being like 3 years.
Okay.
But I tried everything. I tried the meditation route. I tried journaling. I tried listening to like sleep music, working on my sleep. So working out, you know, like I did everything that they say that you're supposed to do, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Other than going to get help.
Yeah.
It's because of what we already talked about. I didn't want to jeopardize training. So, but it did get to the point where I was so terrified that I drove myself to the chaplain and told him.
Terrified
like, this, of my thoughts.
Okay.
Of these just recycling thoughts that, like, it was this ironic thing because you don't know where they're coming from. Mm-hmm. They just start happening. You can't control them because every time you try to do something about it, you're thinking about that thought.
Yeah.
So it's this never-ending cycle, and it's so frustrating and infuriating and terrifying. So,
absolutely.
So yeah, so I got to the point where I was like, you know what, like I'm literally scared that I'm going to do something like that. This is going to overcome me. Mm-hmm. So I went to the chaplain. He drove me to behavioral health. This is in Fort Rucker still.
Okay.
So this is still in flight school.
Early.
Yeah. So this was probably 6 months after like the onset of it all.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And I was just going down this downward spiral just internally though. On the outside looking in, nobody knew anything.
You
know? So go to behavioral health, which was terrifying for me. Like, you know, it could have gone horribly.
Yeah.
Take this little written survey. Literally, it was like a suicide survey. Like, you know, you having suicidal thoughts? Yes. Have you made plans to do it? No. Do you want to do it? No. You know, because I didn't want any of this.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Everything was just there. It was just happening. It wasn't like, I was like, I didn't hate myself. I knew mentally that my life was great. And that was the ironic thing is like, I was like, why is this happening? Because my life is good. You know, like I have everything I could ask for.
Truly intrusive.
But it was still happening, you know, so that was so frustrating. So anyways, I go do that survey. They bring me back and I talk to a lady, and I kid you not, she went through the list in the survey, read the survey, asked me, like, just re-asked me the questions, and basically said, well, since you don't have plans to do it and you don't want to do it, I'm going to let you continue training. Just come back if it gets worse. And I, in my mind, I'm like, it is as worse as it could be, you know, like,
but you're
that's
terrified.
Why I'm here.
Yeah.
Like, so I was so frustrated with that. And so like just torn, cause I didn't know what to do. So I was like, okay, I guess I'm just going to.
And there was no
soldier on.
That's the problem that I see across the board. And, you know, I recently had an experience with the VA mental health as well. You know, but conventional Army in military as well is, it come back to us if it gets better. Well, where's the tools that I could be working on in between this?
Yeah.
And you look at my chart, you look at the page that I filled out, and that's all you're basing your, I could have done this survey online.
I know. And I could have literally, ChatGPT could have told me the same thing.
Exactly. I
mean, they didn't have that back then, but Google could I could have Googled my symptoms.
Yeah, these are my DSM answers.
Yeah. And they would have been like,
yeah,
you should probably see a mental health professional.
Yeah.
You know? But the Army mental health, I mean.
Well, from that perspective too, and just to play devil's advocate, she knows that you're in flight training, and she knows that, hey, like, if you're not planning on doing it, like, it's best for you to not talk to someone if you want to continue with training.
You're right.
So she was doing you a service there.
Yes.
While doing you a disservice.
Agreed. Yeah.
Like, and it really is going to come down to your decision at that point. Like, what was more important to you at that point, or what did you prioritize, or what did you see? Were you actually going to end up taking your life in the next couple of weeks, or could you make it through training? And you obviously did.
Yeah.
But that decision, like, that's the question mark that we can often, you know, do a disservice to other people. Mm. And if it was somebody else in a similar position to you, say they were apprehensive to check that box. Yes, I'm planning on taking my own life. They said no when she asked, but that wasn't the truth.
Right
now she's done them a disservice, and that's going to lead to,
now you're putting them behind a multi-million-dollar asset.
Yeah. With people in the back
that is filled, like essentially a missile.
Yep. And, the lawn dirt.
And she absolutely did you a disservice because, you know, you, with the way she presented that, you felt threatened on your training at that point. So I'm sure you just closed off and you said, yes, ma'am, I'm good to go. Okay, perfect. I'll come back.
Yeah.
And we often feel scared to say, no, this is not going to cut it. I need a little bit more tools.
Yeah, I didn't want to say that.
And you can't, because she literally put it black and white for you.
Yeah.
Of, okay, well, I'm not going to kick you out of school. Well, that's the worst thing you could have said to me. You know, I'm coming to you for help and you're not providing it.
Right.
If it gets worse.
Right. Like, how is there really? No middle ground?
What's, you know, worse, like, me killing myself?
Exactly.
You know,
I mean, that would have, that's literally was the next step.
And, like, and two, we don't think about that too. The professional, the behavioral health specialists need to recognize that out there of saying, this is a cry for help. Mm. You feel threatened on your job. You need to provide a safe space for these guys to come in and work through them with those problems, not read from a chart and say, you know, tell you about yourself.
Yeah. It's not, especially if somebody like turns themselves in.
Yeah.
You know, drives themselves there, like when they know the stakes are high and they know, you know what I mean? So, but yeah, to your point, she was trying to keep me in training, which you're right. Like, she, in her mind, that was probably her intention was, hey, like, this guy seems squared away. Let's keep him in training.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think there should have been some, like, let's follow up, you know, tomorrow, or let's get you talking to somebody.
Yeah.
That won't ground you. Something in between, you know.
The,
agree.
Yeah. So that's, so it gave me a bad taste with the, I mean, I already didn't want to go to behavioral health ever.
Yeah.
I didn't want to be in the parking lot, you know,
unless
I was out processing.
No one does.
So, exactly. So, so that gave me an even worse taste. And I was kind of like, all right, well, I'm not going back there. You know, that they're not going to help me.
Yeah. So you stuff it down for even longer.
Yeah. So, and it was always like looking to the next milestone. To hope it would get better, you know? Like, it was like, all right, let's get to third cab, then it'll be better. Let's go to Afghanistan, then I'll do my job, it'll be better. So it's kind of just always trying to justify.
That's a great thing about the military as well, though, is we distract ourselves so well that we don't get hit until we're in our downtime, yeah. often when we transition out of the military.
Yeah, for sure. So honestly, I think that's what like kept me going, yeah. like looking back on it, other than like family and things like that, but just always having something next. What's yeah. next? What, mm-hmm. you know?
There's always something next.
Right? Like my situation yeah. will get better once this happens. And, it didn't, mm-hmm. but...
How was it during those periods though? So you went to behavioral health during flight training mm-hmm. and here you are, you know, as a 160th pilot still dealing with the same things, you know, years later. Were you going through ebbs and flows? Was it pretty constant and steady or can you even like delineate between?
Yeah. So I actually can. It was something really weird happened to me. Mm-hmm. So when I was in the regular Army the whole time, I was having these like still depression and suicidal thoughts. Mm-hmm. And then once I got picked up for the 160th, actually before that, so in Afghanistan towards the tail end, I started having these dizzy spells, like unexplainable, just my body felt off kilter. It was bizarre. And I thought it was like an inner ear issue or something like that. And I got that checked out and they said it was fine. But I started having these weird dizzy spells. And when I assessed for the 160th, it was like at its worst during assessment week, which is not the time you want it to be. Mm-hmm. It was just awkward. Like I felt like I literally had this feeling of I'm going to fall over all the time. Like we'd be talking right now and my body would just feel off and I would feel like, yeah, it was just weird.
Interesting.
Yeah. So it was bizarre. But once I got picked up for the 160th, my depression started going away a little bit. So it wasn't the constant intrusive thoughts. It was like
more purpose driven.
Yeah. And it was when I'd be going to bed or something, mm-hmm. you know, I'd have those thoughts, but it was just cause my mind was, you know, stagnant and I wasn't yeah. doing anything. Mm-hmm. But other than that, it was getting a lot better, but I was having these dizzy spells. So it morphed into this, mm-hmm. which is weird. And in my mind, it wasn't like my mental health was improving and mm-hmm. now I was having some like physical something
yeah.
like something was off with my body. I didn't think it was my mind still.
Yeah.
So I'm going to kind of go like deep in the story here and the diagnosis and all this stuff and how it happened.
Sure.
But essentially I had these dizzy spells for a long time. And I didn't tell anybody. I was just holding it in, same thing. Cause I was a pilot and it didn't happen when I flew, which was ironic or when I like, I don't know, never did. I don't know if it was the adrenaline or the focus or what, but, so when I had the knee surgery, when I went and got my knee surgery, that's when my wife was like, hey, you need to like, since you're on a down slip already, you can't fly. You need to go talk to somebody and get this figured out. Mm-hmm. So finally did. And initially everybody thought it was the same thing, like not mental health related, right? So got ears checked, neurologist, did every test head to toe. And then finally my flight doc was like, let's get you talking to the psychologist, you know, and just see what happens, you know.
Yeah.
They framed it as a performance enhancement, which I kind of struggle with now, like calling it that, because in my mind it was like, okay, I can't disclose mental health problems because this is a performance enhancing, you know, type of treatment, you know, does that make sense?
Yeah.
So instead of like behavioral health, it was, how can we get you optimal from where you are now instead of diving deep and, you know, getting to the root of the problem. So did that for a long time. And I actually went and got a sleep study done throughout this process. Cause the psychologist was like, maybe it's sleep related, you know, cause I had daytime sleepiness. Mm-hmm. So did that, got a sleep study and came out. I got diagnosed with narcolepsy from a civilian sleep doc.
Oh,
as a pilot.
That is not good.
Not good. Yeah. Right. But the ironic thing is I was sucking so badly with these dizzy spells that it was like a relief. Like it was like, okay, now I have an explanation. Mm. Like I was, maybe I'm having these micro naps and that's what's making my brain, you know, think I'm dizzy or I'm off kilter, you know? Okay. So I was justifying it in my head, like, okay, cool. Like now I have an answer.
Yeah.
You know?
So unfortunately, like a low grade narcolepsy into stage 1-2.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like very mild, you know, like maybe it's just, I don't even know what's happening, but it's happening. Mm-hmm. So that's like a med board right away and a ZQ from flying. So, so now I'm on a downslip. Well, I'm still on a downslip. And we start exploring an MEB, the flight doc does. And the Army makes you take another, Army makes you do a sleep study with them because they have like a watch you have to wear for 2 weeks prior just to make sure all the data is correct and you were actually sleeping before. You know, you don't just show up like, I haven't slept in a week. Yeah. I'm going to sleep. You know?
Yeah.
So you're not, you can't game the game, I guess, or game the system. So did the Army sleep study and it took like 4 months to get the sleep study. And then it was like a month after to get the results. So it was just this purgatory forever.
Yeah.
And by then, like my knee was almost recovered. So I could have almost been back in the cockpit. So I was really anxious to like figure out what was going on.
Sure.
The Army comes back, says I don't have narcolepsy. Mm. Says I have no diagnosable criteria, none of it. And so I'm like, what the hell, man? Like
back to square one.
Yeah, but I'm still grounded. Like they wouldn't put me on an upslip.
Did you notice like a sense of relief? Once you noticed the sense of relief, did you notice those symptoms subside?
No,
unfortunately. So you still had the dizzy spells.
Yep.
Well, yeah. Well, that's just an indicating factor that it could be more physical than mental.
Right, for sure. And I actually got prescribed modafinil after the first narcolepsy diagnosis.
Love modafinil.
So that's a great drug, but when you're having anxiety,
that heightens it.
Intense.
For sure. Yeah.
So perfect. So the dizzy spells got a little worse, honestly.
Yeah.
But
And the shakiness and the anxiety does not make it easy as
exactly.
well.
Exactly.
So you're in a helicopter.
Luckily I wasn't flying or else that would have been a bumpy ride.
Call that SAS 3.
Yeah, seriously.
Helicopter humor.
Yeah, for real.
We had a pilot with tremors. He had physical tremors, like his hands would shake. And we called it SAS 3. Yeah.
Jeez. That's safe. Real safe. Yeah.
Perfect.
So, I apologize. This is long-winded. But
No. This is so great information.
So the Army docs, I don't have narcolepsy. So I go from having it to not having it and still searching for answers. The Army would not do another sleep study. So my flight doc referred me to an outside sleep doc in Savannah for the third one. And I go and talk to him. And he doesn't have the watches that the Army requires for the sleep study. So basically, if I did one with them, the Army wouldn't care.
Yeah.
Like it wouldn't be recognized anyways.
Okay.
So the last thing you can do is a lumbar puncture or spinal tap. And they test for something called hypocretin levels. And that's like indicative of if you have narcolepsy, if you have elevated levels of it. Mm-hmm. So we did that and results came back and I didn't have it still. So now we're like, I'm really like, what the hell, man? Like, because I truly did think that was the answer, or I think I just hoped it was the answer.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, I just wanted something and I wanted to be normal, feel normal. So then after that, this psychiatrist, I started meeting with a psychiatrist and that's when we were like, all right, let's start treating. He was like, let's start treating for anxiety because it might be that. And we've ruled out everything else basically. So I'm down already. So I'm like, okay. Let's fix this. I'm sick of being like this. Let's try something. So I get on Lexapro, and I do start noticing improvements. It wasn't like extreme, but the dizzy spells would become more situational. Mm. So it was, I could recognize after the fact when it happened, I could be like, okay, like I was in this situation. This is why it happened, you know? But the Lexapro wasn't like the answer because it wasn't that much better. It was just a little better. So we kept trying cocktails of drugs, you know.
Of course.
You know the story. Finally get to Effexor and symptoms got a lot better, like probably like 90% better.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very, very situational at this point.
Okay.
And it was 100% like, okay, this is treating it, which was bizarre and took me a while to kind of accept.
Yeah.
But this psychologist after that, so after we like established that this was working, she read the symptoms of panic disorder. And I was like, oh my God, like that's exactly what I've been experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
Like we've been talking for a year, you know? And like to her credit, she wanted to rule everything out first before jumping to a diagnosis like that. Like that was her reasoning. But I was just like, man, like that literally nailed what's been going on with me. And yeah, that's really how I, so then I got med boarded for panic disorder and anxiety, PTSD, you know.
Yeah.
They just lumped it all together. But yeah, so So the biggest lessons learned through that, though, is just like I let it get so bad.
Yeah.
Because I held it in for so long because mm-hmm. I was so scared to get help and talk to people that it got to that point.
Yeah.
You know, like if I would have, if that mental health professional at Fort Rucker had just probably treated me or whatever, got me on a plan or something, like none of that would have happened.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
So it's kind of bizarre to look back on it now.
Let me ask you this, and yeah. it's going to be a very pointed question. Do you now wish, or would you have changed what you said in 2016 when you first went to behavioral health? Now that you know where you're at now and all that you've gone through, would you have given up all of that that you've been through now, you know, being a 160th pilot, all that? Is that something you would have given up to change it?
That is a great question, and my answer would be no. But with that being said, I don't want people to take that as like,
yeah.
I'm not going to get help because
Absolutely. Because
the end result could have been much worse, right?
Mm-hmm. Yours happened to work out.
Yeah, I got lucky. I mean, maybe not lucky, but a lot of things could have gone way worse than it did.
Yeah.
And we've all heard the stories of that soldier that's a stud, you know, that takes his life and you're, everybody's confused. Everybody's like, what happened, you know, and leaves behind his kids and wife and, you know, the tragedy.
Yeah.
And like that would have been me if I would have done it, you know, everybody would have been like, dude, I had no idea. I would have never seen that coming. Even to this day, like I haven't been really public about this except for the last month or so. And I have buddies texting me like, dude, I had no idea. Like you should have said something. And I'm like, yeah, I know. That's the point. That's the point of all of this.
Have you had anybody reach out to you now that you're being more open about this and say that they've been going through the same thing?
Similar, yes. Yeah.
Crazy.
A lot of people.
Crazy, right?
And it's scary, honestly, and mind-blowing.
Yeah.
How many people, like, once you open up, they'll be like, dude, I know. I've done that. I've been through that, too.
Yeah.
Or I'm going through that right now, too. Yeah.
It's crazy. Yeah.
Best kept secret in the military.
Right? Isn't that sad?
Yeah. There's the mental health. So what do you do now to help facilitate that healing?
So the medication is big right now, but I kind of view that as a Band-Aid, you know, as a short-term solution for a long-term problem.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully not a long-term problem, but...
Yeah.
But you know what I mean? So... my outlet right now is really working. I'm building a business right now and then working out and family. So
fantastic.
Those are my real outlets.
Also, when you're not in a set and setting where you're going through an ample amount of experiences, up, right, down, left, right, whatever it is, you're in a more stable environment. You could set a stable routine and just that alone has a tendency to really bring you out of that, especially when you have the support system around you. And funny enough, talking about it the way you're doing now is probably the best therapy for you.
It really is.
When you get into helping people more, that's when you really notice a difference. I mean, when I talk across the board for the foundation or whatever it may be on stage, I'll say things where I'm like, I should do better at that. You know, I need to internalize that. And that is the most healing that's happened for me, is just talking to other people about it. Mm-hmm. And you'd be surprised, and you're seeing this now, at how willing and open people become when you give them that door.
Because they want to be.
Yeah.
Because it feels so good to actually like get literally years of burdens off your chest. Mm.
And think about that too, is as you're sitting there in the parking lot of behavioral health in 2016, you were going through a slight amount of anxiety just thinking about talking about it.
Yes.
And now you could just open up about it on a podcast that reaches thousands and thousands of people. Yeah. I mean, that's huge. That's huge growth. And we have a tendency as people to not see the growth that we're doing too. And just incorporating that into where your journey is now is so empowering.
That's a good point. And it was, honestly, it was terrifying, like to even think of exposing this to people.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like all those negative thoughts come racing back. Like, what are people going to think?
Yeah.
You know, I had a good reputation. Now is it going to be tarnished? Now are people going to look at me as weak? You know, all those things.
Yeah.
Where really the opposite's true. Like,
yeah,
I don't care what people think now, you know?
It's
whatever. I'm happier and my life's on an upward trajectory instead of downward. So
it's brilliant.
Yeah, it's awesome.
People are much more receptive these days, especially with mental health, because people are starting to be more open about it. Like, hey, I'm struggling with that. And people are realizing, oh, like the people I look up to, my mentors or my idols or whoever it is, like, oh, these are just people and they're going through the same exact things that I am.
It's less taboo.
Yeah, very much
so. Yeah, it is.
Less taboo. And and two, we talk about idolizing our leaders in the military. But yet when they're more open about it, and this is a strength for our leadership to open up about these things and say, hey, I have days like that where I have days, months, weeks, whatever it is, where I have suicidal thoughts. And when you tell your people that, all of a sudden you're like, you stop idolizing them so exponentially and saying, I need to stuff it down too. Like, I'm the only one with this problem.
Right.
That's not the case.
Yeah.
Every single person that we talk, I don't care if a 4-star general. Like, we talk to these individuals that are like, yeah, you know, I have to be strong for them. Well, be strong for them by telling them that it's okay to seek help.
Yeah. Be a human.
Yeah. You know?
Like,
you're not a robot.
Exactly.
And that's the whole premise of this show as well, is to showcase the stories of these individuals that are not robots. There's a face behind the uniform.
Yeah, right.
You might fall in line and do the same thing and have a really tough objective, whatever it may be, to go kill terrorists or whatever it is. But at the same time, that's not normal. And that hurts us on the inside to do that. And to be open and forthcoming about it is empowering beyond all belief.
For sure. And especially when you see it at the most elite level, you know, like these guys that are beacons of success and, you know, physical strength, mental strength, everything, you know, you don't get through the special operations, any special operations pipeline with a weak anything.
Yeah.
You know,
true.
You have that drive and you have that, you do have a strong spirit and being vulnerable, things like that is terrifying, but it's so valuable. And I think if we can get that out to even like active duty soldiers, you know, just talk about it.
Even the civilian population, because now they get to see what they've idolized as well.
Yep.
They see the special operations, you have constant exposure to these movies, Oppenheimer, whatever it is. And you see these guys and you think, oh, they got it together. And sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. And when we could associate similar experiences, similar physiological responses, it could help them throughout their journey as well.
For sure. Very good point.
Yeah.
Because, they think of us as, you know, these robots, G.I. Joe, invincible people. And
no.
You're still human. Nice, you know, people. You still have human emotions. Like,
best concept I could give you is grab a G.I. Joe doll and bang it across the wall.
Perfect. Exactly. Times. Rip that arm out.
traumatic brain injury, G.I. Joe. Yeah.
It's not the same.
TBI
anymore.
Joe.
Yeah, TBI Joe. That's good.
So exactly. I love that you're so open about it, especially coming out of the military this May, retired in 2023.
Yeah.
And being so close to that transition period and coming out on top and recognizing these problems and finding solutions in place, and now you're empowered to help others, is commendable at the very least.
Thanks.
So thank you for what you do, and thank you for sharing this story. Absolutely incredible. Is there anything that you would say to the audience, maybe?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is just don't be scared to be vulnerable. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't make you less of a person. It doesn't make you weak. It doesn't make you anything other than strong. Like, if you get help, if you talk to somebody, tell your best friend about it, like, they're going to support you. Yeah. They're not going to think you're weak or weird or any of the stigmas that are out there. Like, that's the biggest, I think, piece of advice that I could give to people is, even if you don't want to go to behavioral health because of the career, you know, repercussions that could happen or whatever, just get it off your chest and talk to somebody.
Talk to someone.
Nobody's going to think you're weird. Nobody's going to think you're insane. All those negative thoughts that you keep telling yourself why you don't reach out to somebody or talk to somebody is just yourself telling you that. You're your worst, you know, advocate. Mm-hmm. So that'd be my biggest thing that I want to get out there, is just
fantastic.
Don't be scared, man.
Fantastic. We you know, Christian nails this on the head with every time, is the oxygen mask theory.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't help others if you don't help yourself.
Exactly.
And you have to help yourself, fix yourself before going in, right? We can't function at 70, 60, 50% of what our capabilities are. We need to address those issues so we could get back, perform to our optimal levels, kick ass and take names.
Yep. And don't let it get worse, right? Mm-hmm. Like don't let stop it, get worse. It right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Attack it and then take control of your life again, you know?
Yeah. The longer you let it go, the harder it is to turn around. You can still turn it around.
For sure.
It becomes exponentially more difficult.
Yeah. That knife just keeps twisting, right?
Yep.
That's it. Yeah. Multiple fronts to the battlefield. And the battlefield of the mind is a really, really important one. And I think over the last few years, we've really recognize the importance of that.
Yeah.
And we are addressing that in the military. Mm. You have these safe spaces where you could go to now without repercussion of getting fired.
Exactly. Yeah.
So and you might be grounded for 6 months,
right,
a year, but in the longevity of your life,
yeah,
what is that?
And look at the alternative, right? Like,
yeah,
do something that's life-changing in a negative way, like potentially for not just you, but your family, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or be grounded for 6 months to a year, or whatever it is, whatever career they're in.
Or find a new job.
Right.
Sorry.
Right.
Can't do this one.
You'll still be okay.
Yeah.
And you won't be dealing with that anymore, hopefully. Yeah. That's the intent.
Where can we find you at?
Yeah, so I am on Instagram at Task Force Stigma. So I'm actually writing a book called Stigma, and it's kind of over this whole premise of these stigmas in mental health. Like towards mental health in your own brain, you know, the things that we tell ourselves that are lies and that keep us from getting help.
Absolutely. So,
love that. When's the book come out?
I'm planning on this spring.
Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome.
So I'm planning on spring.
We'll have to have you back on once it comes out.
Yeah. I can't wait.
Absolutely.
I can't wait.
Yeah.
Love it.
Perfect. Well, thanks very much for joining us today, Nick. It was a real pleasure getting to learn more about you, and thanks for opening up.
No, you guys too. Thanks for having me. It's platforms like this. You guys don't know how valuable it is to people.
Well,
you
appreciate that.
Seriously.
Yeah. Appreciate it. And appreciate difference. You coming on. You know, it's guests like yourself and the stories that they bring to the table that make this show possible and educate the audience, whatever background they come from.
Sure.
So thank you.
Yeah. No, thank you guys. Appreciate it.
Nick O'Kelly, ladies and gentlemen, this has been the Medevac Podcast. Thanks for watching today. Don't forget to head over to medevacpodcast.com if you want to get in touch with myself, Dave. Tell us who you want to hear from, what stories or topics you want to hear about. And then go over to social media, Instagram, at Medevac Podcast, M-E-D-E-V-A-C Podcast. Interact with that stuff. Let us know what you think. We'll see you next time.
Until next time.
Bye.